Brethren, to begin our convention, we have the privilege of having Brother Paul Malley with us, and he's chosen as his subject, The Battle for Jerusalem. The Battle for Jerusalem. Brother Paul.
It's always a privilege for me to be in convention with the Lord's people. I bring you the love and greetings of your brethren in the Groton, New London, Connecticut area, and also the brethren from the Southwest Florida group. We were in touch with them recently, and they wanted to be remembered to you. Also, Sister Mary, she wanted to send her greetings and love to you. She's always with me, but this time she couldn't make it, so... And my daughter Dawn and son-in-law Russell Shalou, they wanted also to be remembered to you as well. Jerusalem is one of the few ancient cities that have survived to the 21st century. Babylon, not only in ancient cities, but one of the cities, one of the wonders of the seven wonders of the ancient world, has not survived. Babylon is gone. Memphis, Giza, Tyre, Sidon, Ur, Sumeria, all ancient cities, all gone. But Jerusalem stands out as a survivor. That's noteworthy. It exhibits a past so alive in its present. Jerusalem's history has had many scenarios. It's been a city of peace. The name means city of Salem, city of peace. Yet Jerusalem has not seen peace at all. Too loud, too soft? Too soft? We're saying that Jerusalem has not seen the city of peace, has not seen peace. It's been conquered 37 times and destroyed 18 times. Surprisingly, it manages to rise with an uncanny vitality. There's no other city in the world that has gone through these cycles of life and death, cycles of life and death, rises and it declines and so on. Jerusalem is truly an eternal city. To walk the streets of Jerusalem is literally to walk on the top of the world's largest battlefield. If you consider the millions of people who have left their lives, they're either attacking it or defending it. I think the record shows 1.1 million people were killed in 70 AD alone when the Romans had destroyed Jerusalem. Today, Jerusalem, especially the Temple Mount or Moriah, is likely to trigger the next world war, or even Jacob's trouble. Jerusalem is a holy city for Jews and Muslims and Christians and maybe a half a dozen other religions. And in her streets have walked men who have claimed they were sent by God. Can they do that in Chicago? I don't think so. Can they do that in New York? Can they do that in Columbus? Or Detroit? There are people who claim that they talk to God in Jerusalem. The prophecies are clear that the future role of Jerusalem is an exciting role, a superlative role. Jeremiah 3:17, at that time they shall call Jerusalem the throne of the Lord, and all the nations shall be gathered into it. Isaiah 56, 6 to 7. Jerusalem will be the home of prayer for all nations. And Isaiah 2, 2 to 4. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. But friends, there are other scriptures that make the future of Jerusalem frightening. Zechariah 12:3, I will make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all the nations. And Zechariah 12:2, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling for all people. And Joel 3:1, for behold, in those days I shall bring again the captivity of Jerusalem. The battle for Jerusalem is shaping up. The wars of religions continue throughout the world, but they're now focused in Jerusalem. It's the only city I know where the vote is still given to the dead. The dead still run the city. Does that surprise you? The dead is still alive, if I could use that metaphor. For Jews, the Jerusalem is the capital of memories. Go to the Wailing Wall and you'll see what I mean. For the Muslims, Jerusalem is the capital of the Holy One, Muhammad. He's still alive for them there. And for Christians, Jerusalem is the capital of the ecumenical church. Jerusalem is a city of three Sabbaths, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Friday, the Muslims. You hear the electronic prayers going through all of the speaker systems. Five times a day, by the way. Five times. Early in the morning and throughout the day. These electronic prayers going out to summon the people up to the mosque. That's on Friday. On Saturday, you hear the sirens declaring the beginning of the Sabbath. And that goes through the whole city. You can't miss it, no matter where you are. Close yourself in the closet, you could still hear it. And then Sunday, the church bells ring all day long. Today, Arafat has threatened holy war to liberate Jerusalem. He wants it the capital of Palestine. Rabin, before he was assassinated, said it will be the capital of Israel. You get the position now? Arafat really stirred a lot of anger in the Israelis recently with a speech calling for a jihad. You know, the word jihad means holy war. Holy war to liberate Jerusalem. You know, when Israel annexed Jerusalem, the West Bank, 3 weeks after it was captured, on June 6, 1967, the Jews proclaimed it to be united and the capital of Israel, and it will stay that way eternally. Of course, not many countries have recognized that statement. But one must be careful about Arafat. He's always in the news. He speaks with a two-forked tongue, like a snake. In one fork he speaks peace, and in the other fork he speaks holy war. Now, when we speak for the Battle of Jerusalem, we're referring to both external powers as well as internal. For the Battle of Jerusalem may very well be Jews versus Jews. That's an idea that is so difficult to understand. Jews versus Jews? Well, we've come to realize that this is a possibility. Or it could be Jews versus Arabs. Or it could be Jews versus the government. Or it could be Jews versus the United Nations. Or it could be Jews versus the world. There cannot be no solution to the Palestinian question without the settlement of the Jerusalem question. Now, let's go back a little bit. Pick up some scenarios that's leading up to this battle. And I'd like to do this in the context of a time clock. There is a time clock going on, friends. Do you hear it? Do you hear the ticking? There's some loud ticks, some loud ringing. If you say I can't hear it, if you say all I can hear is my Seiko watch, then you are not listening. Or maybe you don't have the ears for listening. Remember how the scriptures say, he who has ears, let him hear. There's a time clock going on. The ticking is going on. And I'm just going to just quickly go over and pick up some of those ticks. It all started in 1878. What happened in 1878 was the Berlin Congress of Nations, where Jews from all over the world met in Berlin to encourage the settlement in Palestine. And literally 15 Russian Jews settled in the first kibbutz called Petah-Tikva. Then the second ring of the clock was in 1896. Herzl publishes The Jewish State, a paper, as a result of anti-Semitism in Europe. And the Zionist Congress elected Herzl as the first president. Zionists declared Palestine as the homeland for the Jews. Interesting to note that Herzl, who was an assimilated Jew, a very successful lawyer in Vienna, at first had no interest in the homeland for the Jews. He was interested in solving the anti-Semitic problem. That's what he was interested in doing. He wanted to solve that problem in Europe. And it's now a historic fact. He went to the Catholic Church pleading with them for help in the anti-Semitism episodes. He even said to the Catholic Church, if you will help me solve the anti-Semitic problem, I will help you convert Jews to Catholicism. This is Herzl. I don't have to, I think, explain to you who he is in the eyes of the Jews. The Catholic Church turned him down. And that's when he wrote his paper and said the only solution to the Jewish question was a homeland. Then there's the third ring of the clock in 1903. When C.T. Russell learned that the Jews were looking to set up a state in Uganda, Africa. The reason, some Jews saw that the defeat of the Muslim Ottoman Empire, who controlled Palestine at the time, was impossible. How are we going to get rid of those Muslims? The promise is we would return to the homeland. But the Muslims were there, the Ottoman Empire. And those of you familiar with the Ottoman Empire, they were there for hundreds of years. They said it was impossible, and C.T. Russell wrote to the Jewish leaders discouraging the use of the Uganda site. And it worked. They abandoned that proposal. You know, there's another miracle. If you're looking for miracles, friends, they're there. Can you imagine? Here they didn't want to go because the Ottomans were going to be there for the next 500 years. The Ottomans are gone. and Israel is in. That's a miracle, in my opinion. Then there's the fourth ring of the clock in 1917 with the Balfour Declaration, where Lord Balfour favored Palestine as a homeland for the Jews. I read the original note, by the way, at Hebrew University. You know, everybody has a notion of what this Balfour Declaration is. I imagine if I asked you, what's in your mind about the Balfour Declaration? I'm sure some of you say, it must be a document that thick. You know how these bureaucrats are. It must be a document that thick. Friends, the Balfour Declaration is a little memorandum. The original. That wide, that high. Two paragraphs. That's all. I saw the original. Right there at Hebrew University. They had it on an exhibition. That's all it was. Stating we favor the Jews, a homeland for the Jews in Palestine. But what happened is Lord Simpson, later, after Balfour was out, he changed the minds of the British about the Balfour Declaration, and this reversal was a big problem for the Jews, as you know. Big problem. And it was a problem for the British Empire, too, because as a result of that reversal, England, the master of the world, who owned half the world, what happened to them? Little by little, they lost their empire. Some of you remember how when you look at a world map, England was always in pink. Remember that? And if you looked at the pink, India, Australia, Africa, Middle East, owned half the world. Where are they now? Just one little island. And I could argue with you that if it wasn't for the United States, I don't know where they'd be. The scriptures say, I will bless them that bless thee, and I will curse them that curse thee. It cost England a great deal for that reversal. Then in 1925, Hebrew University opened its doors to the development of its young people. You've got to remember that a university preserves and perpetuates a country's knowledge and its culture. And we now see in retrospect that Hebrew University, with 40,000 students, was mostly responsible for the 500,000 archaeological artifacts discovered in the various holy sites. Now, friends, this is big. Because I'm sure you've wondered, how is it in these recent years that there's been so much discovery in the Holy Land? And this discovery, if it's done anything, has confirmed the scriptures, has confirmed the Bible, has confirmed the various sites, so that they're no longer looked at as fictitious stories, hand-me-downs. They were real. And the Hebrew University was the largest contributor toward that movement of confirming the Bible. You know, when I was at Hebrew University, the students came from all over the world. I had students from Chicago and from New York and from Africa. They were Jews, though. And from China. What were they doing there? They were learning the Hebrew language. They were learning the Hebrew laws and the Judaic traditions. So, in 1925 was a big ring of the clock, because not only was ready for its inception as a country and a government, but now the university was picking up with the young people, and with the young people comes the movement for perpetuating their history. Then the sixth ring of the clock was in 1945, when the Holocaust victims were discovered. 6 million Jews died. They were killed. It awakened and sobered the world for the need for a Jewish state. The fishers and the hunters of Jeremiah 16:16, they forced the Jews out of the woodwork, so to speak. They were hiding because they were afraid. I can't think of any people that's been burned and killed and murdered and raped, and we can go right down the list what they've been through. The wandering Jew. There was no home for the wandering Jew. He was kicked out of everywhere he went. And again, a homeland was the only answer. Seventh ring of the clock was in 1948. The ring was loudest. Three things happened. Israel became a nation, the time of the Gentiles was over, and the regathering of the Jews from all over the world was accelerated. It was a time when God took Ezekiel in chapter 37 to the valley of the dry bones and said, "Son of man, can these bones come to life?" And the Son of Man said, "Lord, only you know." "I don't know, but only you." And God said, "Watch." And this tremendous shaking started, and the bones began to move, and the leg bone moved to the hip bone, which together moved to the shoulder bone, which together the leg bone moved to the hip, which moved to the head bone. All the bones assembled themselves into skeletons. Picture that in your mind, friends. And picture Ezekiel, the Son of Man, watching this phenomena of these bones coming together. The shaking represents the seven trumpets sounding, bones with bones representing the regathering, the sinews and the muscles representing the strength of their hope, the flesh representing the return of the Jewish culture and their community, and the skin representing the protection given to the regathered Jews in Israel. Breath has not come, though, and will not come until the new covenant is made with Israel. For God will give them the breath. Eighth ring of the clock was in 1954. When Stalin answered, or when Stalin was dealing with the Jewish question again and announced that he has the solution to the Jewish problem. So Stalin says that in the state of Berobidzin, friends, if you don't know where that is, let me say, look for the North Pole and then come down a few miles into Siberia, and there's Berobidzin, a frozen north. Stalin and Stalin alone determined to send 4 million Jews in Russia to undergo a frozen existence in Berobidzin in Siberia. He made that decision. You know, as we look back, again, we see Israel going through many, many cycles of life and death. Assyria assimilated the 10 tribes. Babylon exiled the 2 tribes. Greece Hellenized the Jews. The Romans scattered the Jews. The Germans exterminated the Jews. The Russians were going to freeze the Jews out of existence. What keeps these tenacious Jews alive? Well, in this particular case, God stepped in. God stopped Stalin in 1954 with a massive brain stroke, which brought about his death and the death of his proposal. That was 2 weeks after he made the Berobidzin proposal. Let's take the ninth ring of the clock, 1967. When Jerusalem in total became the capital of Israel. Now, don't treat this lightly, friends. Jerusalem becoming the capital of Israel is the preliminary step of Jerusalem becoming the capital of the world. Remember Isaiah 2:3-4. For out of Zion shall come forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. Powerful things are happening in Jerusalem since 1967. Jerusalem has now become the target for most nations. The Muslim nations, all the Arab nations, India, Pakistan, Turkey, Africa, several Russian Muslim provinces also want Jerusalem because of the Temple Mount. The Christian nations, all of Europe, United States, South America, they want Jerusalem as an international city because of the holy sites. The Jews with the Jewish diaspora, Israel, throughout the world, want Jerusalem because of its symbol of political restoration. It's closely aligned with Messiah. The Messiah is still alive with the Jews. But they're hung up that this Messiah must be a political deliverer. And they stumbled over the Messiah as the suffering servant. They didn't see the connection. Rather interesting with the Dead Sea Scrolls that are being examined by all and the Essenes that were a group in Jerusalem at the time. The Essenes read the scriptures in Isaiah. They were logical people. They say, we see two groups of scriptures. We see the Messiah coming as a suffering servant. And then we see another group of scriptures. We see the Messiah coming as a political deliverer. So the Essenes began to argue with the Pharisees and with the Sadducees and saying, there must be two Messiahs. One coming as the suffering servant and the other one coming as a king. The Pharisees were so upset about that, they kicked him out of Jerusalem. And those of you who have been to Israel, you remember the Qumran caves that you visited. But you may have forgotten there was a Qumran community around there. And that's where they located themselves. Brilliant, the Essenes. Brilliant. As far as human genius is concerned. They said there must be two Messiahs. Look at the scriptures. That's what it points out to, you see. But they weren't spiritual enough to see that it's one Messiah with two comings. That's a spiritual idea. That's not got anything to do with human genius. But they were smart enough to see the way. The Pharisees ignored the suffering servant, and therefore when Jesus came, he was a stumbling block to them. Right after World War I, the League of Nations were considering locating themselves in Jerusalem. That was where their headquarters was going to be. And right after 1948, the statehood of Israel, the United Nations wanted to make Jerusalem an international city. Even the Pope asked for Jerusalem to be an international city. Now, these discussions are leading to an interesting principle. That the nations want to be in league with God. That the nations want to be aligned with God. That the nations want to have a connection with God. That the nations sense that their destiny is somehow connected with Jerusalem. If they connect with Jerusalem, somehow or other they are connected with God in their intuitive insight. The tenth ring of the clock was in 1987 when the Russian Jews were allowed to immigrate to Israel and they've been pouring in at the rate of 100 to 200 in one day. The immigration still continues. They're still coming in. In fact, the 5 million plan for Israel has been changed recently to the 7 million. And the Russian Jews keep immigrating to Jerusalem as a unique fulfillment of Jeremiah 31:8. I will bring them from the north country, which is Russia. Then came the 11th ring of the clock in 1994 with the interim peace process. Israel has wanted peace since 1948. That's 48 years ago. Five wars and a Scud missile skirmish has been their experience. Five Arab nations and many other cooperating nations also wanted peace. Russia and the United States have been co-sponsors of the peace process, and Clinton is serious about settling the Israeli-Arab conflict. Peres, long known as a hawk, has been smitten with moderation. All of this is moving the peace process forward. It is happening. It is happening. Peace has been signed between three countries in Israel: Egypt, the PLO, and Jordan. That's a matter of record. Peace now exists between them, at least on paper. Syria remains. But they're meeting right now just outside of Washington in Maryland. And the report has it that they're going to make it. It's going to happen. This is all moving the peace process forward. I'm going to come back to that in a moment. But let's get back to the 12th ring of the clock, which happened in November 4th, 1995, with the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. History will show that the assassination of Rabin will be a ring of God's time clock. It's paradoxical. Rabin supported and even gave leadership to the law of the return and the development of the settlers. Rabin helped in the settler movement, a movement that took his life. The very people who he helped took his life. The blood of the man of peace has now watered the tree of peace. I'm going to miss Yitzhak Rabin. I've watched this Israeli leader with a lot of admiration, particularly to see a military man. He was a general, a military man. He was the one in the 1967 war that was the hero. To watch this military man turn into a peace dove is a miracle in itself. The shock of a Jew killing a Jew is almost unheard of, but it's opening it up. It shows the deep division in Israel, a division that's getting worse. 59 out of 120 in the Knesset voted against what Rabin was doing. He lived with opposition. He had the courage and the persistence not found in Israel. The loss of Rabin is more than the loss of a prime minister, more than the loss in Israel, more than the loss in the world. It is an historic loss. You know, there's a parallel between the assassination of Rabin with Abraham Lincoln. If you recall in history, Lincoln wanted to keep the country together. He wanted to unite them over the issue of slavery. He was assassinated by one who was against unification. Rabin gave his life for peace, but it was to keep Israel from falling apart from outside forces and from forces within. The parallel of Lincoln with Rabin is very unique. And when Lincoln was gone, no one was there to fill his shoes. Will this be the same with Rabin? Will the assassination shock reunite Israel? Is there a message here from God? Is God saying, I want the peace process? Is God saying, I don't want the peace process? What is the Lord saying about this process and the giving of land? A quick guess, and a very important point to emphasize. What God wants right now is the regathering and the returning of the Jews to Israel from all over the world, no matter what the costs are. Anybody who gets in that way, be it individuals, be it countries, be it regions, whatever. Anyone getting in that way is going to have to be dealt with by God Himself. That's what God is doing. Now, the diaspora is over. The bones are now coming together. We see several meanings to the assassination of Rabin. And I'm going to, in a summary way, give you my view of this. What does the assassination of Rabin mean? Because that's the closest ring of the clock. Just happened a couple of months ago. What does it mean? Have you raised that question, friends? You should. And I'm sure some of you have come up with your own answers. And that's why we have conventions to share with one another. And I'd be very happy to hear your points of view. But let me give you my points of view. There's several meanings I see to this. The first, the assassination may have averted a civil war. And God does not want a civil war in Israel at the time when the Jews are returning to Israel. Can you imagine a Russian Jew? There's still 2.5 million of them in Russia. Can you imagine them? I want to go to Israel when it's in a civil war. You know where they want to go if that's the case? In fact, they still want to do it. Where do they think they want to go? To Chicago. Israel has a split, 49% to 51% over the peace process. But the episodes of hostility between the Jewish settlers and the Arabs, and the Jewish settlers and other settlers, Jewish settlers and the police, the Jewish settlers and the government, flare up. And they occur over the Temple Mount. They occur over discontent. They occur over giving of the land away. And let's not forget the hostility between the Orthodox with the secular, the Orthodox with the Arabs, the Orthodox with the government. The Orthodox are against the government. They don't want to have anything to do with the government. They hate the government. They want the government to fail. Why? Because they want the Messiah to start the new Israeli government. Not what's in there now. In the Knesset, they shout and scream at each other. Is it possible to arrive at peace when you're shouting and screaming? Now, these are signs. They have been earmarks of an impending, not only there is a division, but a real split into a civil war. And the assassination of Rabin may have averted that civil war. Now, we don't know for sure. But if we had to put one meaning to it, we would say that the split, you see, has not become so severe now. It's been calming down. Let's take the second meaning. The assassination of Rabin has helped the peace process. The hostility between the Likud party and the Labor party has diminished. The two parties are more amiable. I'm not saying they're in love with each other. It's like Washington's Congress versus Bill Clinton. Are they in love with each other? You know there's a political war going on in Washington. It's a political war. I know maybe some of you are furloughed because you work for the government. Good time to be furloughed. Go to the convention. So, a sympathetic reaction has emerged from the Rabin assassination. Many of the Likuds are now supporting the peace process. Peres has completed his reorganization of government, and the Likuds did not make any issue of it at all with the reorganization and the challenges. Is it possible that God wants the peace process to go ahead? Because it is going ahead. Is this what the assassination means? Let's take a third meaning. The assassination has defined Israel's lovers. Remember in the Jeremiah 30:14, all of Israel's lovers will leave her. I'm sure we all are familiar with that text. And we're saying that there'll be a time when they'll all leave. What, do you know who these lovers are? Well, it's rather interesting. At Rabin's funeral, 86 countries were represented with 42 heads of state or presidents of state. They traveled thousands of miles to pay respect to Rabin and Israel. Israel still has her lovers. The lovers have not left her yet. The funeral showed it. The prophecy is yet to be fulfilled. Even the arch enemies of Israel, Egypt and Jordan, they came to Jerusalem to express their sympathy. The PLO and Arafat would have come, but it was advised not to because of some local reaction. King Hussein called Rabin his brother. That's historic. I don't think you'll ever find any Arab calling a Jew a brother. And he called his wife a sister. Analysts have compared the Rabin funeral to that of Winston Churchill and John Kennedy. So we see one meaning is that the lovers have not left Israel yet. Let's take a fourth meaning of the assassination. It's in Jerusalem itself. The last piece of land under contention, the last piece of land that will go into negotiations, the last piece of land that may bring down the roof. Look who wants Jerusalem. The Jews want Jerusalem. They claim it as a divine right since the time of the Gentiles are over. God has regathered them to this historic borders. The Muslims want Jerusalem. Arafat has already claimed Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine. The Saudis have promised $1 billion to the PLO to develop Jerusalem as an Arab capital. The rock in the Dome of the Rock is a very important thing. To pay $1 billion, you could see how they regard that rock. Then the Christians want Jerusalem. The Pope wants it as an international city. And there are diplomatic relations between Israel and the Vatican that's been established. Even Rabin went to the Vatican for advice. You remember that news clip? Showed the picture. Rabin in Rome looking for advice. Of course, I don't think there's anything wrong with looking for advice. I think we should do that all the time. But do we see any scenarios beyond that meaning? Now we have a new group that wants Jerusalem. The Russian Orthodox. The Russian Orthodox, since communism went out or had collapsed, coming back in, demands a status in Jerusalem. They've joined with the Greek Orthodox, with the Armenians, and with the Latin Patriots to have a role in the control of Jerusalem. Well, the reason why that's significant is because the Russian Orthodox are now become political. They are representatives in the Russian cabinet, in the Russian Congress. And as you see that, if they want and cannot get a role in Jerusalem, we could see now the impact coming in from the other side. The Protestants want Jerusalem, especially evangelicals, since they connect the second coming of Christ as the Messiah to Jerusalem. So, you know, our evangelical friends, they're all looking for the Messiah to come, the second coming. But if you ask them, where is he going to arrive? They'll say Jerusalem. You see. And there we see all the sides jockeying for a coming battle. Three quarters of the world want Jerusalem. The United Nations will get involved to coordinate the and focus the predators as they go after the prey. The battle for Jerusalem has started. Jerusalem may very well be the spoil that will precipitate Gog of the North. Let's take a fifth meaning to the Rabin assassination. The giving away of land for peace is at the crossroads. Peres has succeeded to get Syria to the negotiation table, and he's prepared to give up the Golan Heights. As I understand it, they are going to give up the Golan Heights. What held them up was that the Israelis wanted a warning tower on the Golan, a very large warning tower to sense when missiles or airplanes are coming over, because there's only a 16-minute delay between what is started in Syria and what happens in Israel. 16 minutes. And so they need this tower to enlarge on the time, to give them more time. You can't even get the pilots into the plane if they started coming over with their planes. It's so close. So that was what was holding up on this. The United States, oh, that's no problem. We will give you a satellite. We will give you satellite sensing equipment. You can, with the satellites, get instant notice of any kind of missile coming over or any plane coming over. So the United States has given them this equipment. I'm not saying that they gave it to them, but it's part of this package, because Israel wanted a security to that. So, and like I said, they're meeting right now in Maryland. The peace process in which land is given for peace has divided the Jews with the Jews. It has divided the Jews with the Arabs. It has divided, surprisingly, the Bible students with the Bible students. The brethren are divided over this issue of giving up of land. Some of you have some very strong feelings about this. Some brethren say, this peace process is for real. It is the beginning of 1 Thessalonians 5:3, which states, they shall say peace and safety, and then sudden destruction shall come upon them as travaileth upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape. This group of brethren say in Ezekiel 38, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages to those who are at rest and peace. Interesting to note, Secretary of State Christopher, who says Syria is willing to pipe oil and water across Israel's borders, and discussions are underway to allow people to pass across the borders like they do in Europe. Those of you in Europe, as Americans, when you go to cross the border, they say, where's your passport? But the Europeans don't have to do that. They go across without the use of passports. They want that same scenario down in between Syria and, I mean, it's now up for grabs in the negotiation table. So, of course, these people say that this peace process is the peace and safety prophecy. But then if you ask them, Israel has not occupied all the land promised by God. Now these brethren will respond by saying, Israel will get all her land with the full establishment of the kingdom. Now there's another group of brethren who feel that peace won't come into Israel until it occupies all the land that God has promised her. Take a look at these scriptures. They define that land. Deuteronomy 34, 1-4. Exodus 23-31. Deuteronomy 3, 27-28. These brethren say the peace process is leading to another war. Jeremiah 31, 5-10 talks about the vineyards in Samaria and the watchmen on Mount Ephraim. They are both in the West Bank. How can you plant vineyards in the West Bank when you've given them up to the Palestinians? Also, there is Isaiah 11, 14-16. Talks about flying on the shoulders of the Philistines toward the west. That's Gaza. and spoiling them in the land of Edom and Moab and Ammon, which are areas now found in Jordan. This means any peace agreement will explode until Jordan or the West Bank will be reacquired. So there you have the two scenarios with the Bible students. I don't know if any of you have given them, I'm sure many of you have given serious thought about this. Which camp are you in? Are you in the camp that this peace process is for real? And it's going to lead to that peace and safety and sudden destruction? Or are you in the camp which states that, the peace process is only leading to another war and the reacquisition of all that land? Whichever camp you're in, the battle for Jerusalem fits with both scenarios. It will be the spoil which motivates Gog's invasion in the first position. It will be the spark that triggers the reacquisition of the West Bank and the land that was lost. In either event, because Jerusalem is the last piece of land to be negotiated. So polarization is not only in Israel, but it's also among the Bible students. You know, brethren, just recently we've become interested in the elections in Russia. The elections. The latest is communism is now emerging as a leading power in Russia. Will communism return to Russia? Will communism be the same Stalin format? Will communism return with a flavor of democracy or a flavor of Islam or a flavor of fascism? We don't know. We're going to watch it. The battle for Jerusalem is part of this because of those various groups that we say want Jerusalem. And I'm not sure, is it possible that God has allowed Rabin to be assassinated because Rabin might have been tempted to give up one half of Jerusalem to the Green Line prior to the 1967 war? If this is a true interpretation of God's hand in Israel, then truly the Battle of Jerusalem has not only started, but will involve the whole world. Remember, this is in Zechariah 12:3. Jerusalem will be a burdensome stone for all people. All that burden themselves with Jerusalem shall be cut in pieces, though there all the nations of the earth be gathered together against it. Let's get back to the rings of the time clock. Let's take a look, the future activities. Here are some of the potential things that will happen. Regathering to the land will continue. In my view, it's probably the most identifiable act that God is doing right now. Nothing will stop that. So regathering under the law of the return will continue, but it will enhance conflicts between the settlers, the Arabs, the police, the governments, and so forth. That's Jeremiah 30, 3-7. The transference of land to the Arabs will be the beginning of another war, where the land will be reacquired. God's command, even though it's difficult to see, there will be peace after that. God's command, another one is God's command to remove detestable things is a big problem. Ezekiel 16, 18. The mosque at the Temple Mount is a detestable thing. So is the Holy Sepulchre, which is a big cash register. I don't know how many of you, when you visited Israel, and I know there are a lot of you here that have gone to visit. I don't know if you went to the Holy Sepulchre. I would suspect you have. But you probably did not go into the cavern underneath where reputedly Jesus was buried. I did. I went there. And as I went down in there, and you have to bend down and crawl a little bit. And then when I stood up, there was the stone with money all on top of it. So it's a big cash register. So water scarcity is still another ring on the clock. This is a very serious thing. Diverting the Jordan River in Syria or in Jordan will cause an enormous conflict. But we think that's up for the negotiations in this table. Syria is willing to pipe water in from their water supply. Let's see. We have a few minutes left. There are other things that we could see. We see that communism seems to be emerging, and the Russian Orthodoxy is a very important thing to watch. It's on the rise, and it spells serious anti-Semitic troubles. In a major article in the Jerusalem Post, there was a quotation from a special interview made with the prosecutor general of the Soviet Union, whose name was Valentin Rasputin. The prosecutor general said the Jews should feel responsible for the sin of carrying out the Bolshevist revolution and for the shape it took. He stated that the Jews played a big role for killing God, because as you know, the Russian Orthodox see Jesus as God, a big role for killing God and for establishing communism. Friends, you know what the implication for this is? The communists want to blame the Jews for the mess they are in. And it is true that 50 men who seized control of the Bolshevist revolution in 1916 were Jews. So if the communists, this includes Russia and the eastern countries and so forth, believe that the Jews were responsible for the mess that they're in, the Jews will be seen as a scapegoat. They want a scapegoat for the failure that they had. Then there are the discontents in the world. Joel 2:11. And by discontents, we mean those who don't have enough food in their table, don't have jobs. They're discontent. A new principle has emerged as a result of this. It was the thing that broke down the separation in the two Germanies and reunited them. The principle is this, that historically and traditionally, it's the politics that always drove the economics. The principle is reversed now. It's the economics that will drive the politics. Food on the table is more important than anybody in government, because it's a democracy now. And so we see this principle emerge, and we think the principle is the one that will be operated with the discontents of Joel 2:11. Let me conclude. No, I'm going to give you the no rain prediction, which would be another ring of the clock, still in the future. Water in the Middle East has arrived at a crisis state. And there is a prophecy, a no rain prophecy, in Zechariah 14:16-21. And the prophecy seems to be one in which there will be punishment for certain countries. Let me conclude, friends. In these last days, Israel has become God's time clock. If you want to know what God is doing, look to Israel. A time clock that stopped ticking 2,520 years ago, and suddenly it has begun to tick again. It is ticking as if it's toward a deadline. It's ticking as if it's in a countdown. It's ticking as if events are moving to a great spectacular. And friends, you know what a countdown is. It's diminishing time to start the major new event according to the plan of the ages. Watch Israel, and you will see God's hand. Watch Israel, and you will see God deliver his people. Watch Israel, and you will see a great miracle of our time. Never let it be said we have not lived in a time of miracles. As we read the miracle of Lazarus, who was dead and being brought to life, we now see Israel was dead. It is now being resurrected. Israel was lost. It is now found.
We certainly live in a wonderful time.